The exact opposite of this ethical principle is the Kantian. Act in such a way that the bases of your action are applicable to all human beings. This sentence is the death of all individual impulses of action. My standard cannot be how all humans would act, but rather what I am to do in the individual case. A superficial judgment might perhaps object to these arguments by saying, how can an action be formed individually for the particular case and the particular situation, and yet simultaneously be determined purely conceptually, out of intuition? This objection rests on confusing the ethical motive with the perceptible content of an action. The latter can be a motive, and even is so, for example, in the case of the progress of civilization, in egoistic actions, etc. In actions based on purely ethical intuition, it is not the motive. Naturally, my capital I directs its gaze toward the perceptual content, but it does not allow itself to be determined by it. The content is used only to form a cognitive concept for oneself. The corresponding moral concept is not derived by the I from the object. The cognitive concept of a particular situation that I encounter is also a moral concept only when I come from the standpoint of a particular moral principle. If I wanted to base all my actions on the moral evolution of civilization, then I would have fixed marching orders. From every event that I perceive and that can possibly concern me, an ethical duty immediately arises, namely to do my part so that the event in question serves the evolution of civilization. In addition to the concept which reveals to me the context of an event or thing in natural law, the event or thing also has an ethical label with instructions addressed to me, the moral being, about how I should behave. Such a moral label is legitimate in its sphere, but on a higher level it coincides with the idea that reveals itself to me when I face a concrete situation. People vary in their capacity for intuition. For one person, ideas just bubble up, while another achieves them by much labor. The situations in which people live and which serve as the scene of their activity are no less varied. How I act will therefore depend on how my capacity for intuition works in relation to a particular situation. The sum of ideas active within us, the real content of our intuitions, constitutes what is individual in each of us, notwithstanding the universality of the world of ideas. To the extent that the intuitive content turns into action, it is the ethical content of the individual. Allowing this intuitive content to live itself out fully is the highest driving force of morality. At the same time, it is the highest motive of those who realize that in the end all other moral principles unite within it. We can call this standpoint ethical individualism. What is decisive in an intuitively determined action in a concrete instance is the discovery of the corresponding completely individual intuition. At this level of morality, we can speak of general moral concepts, norms, or laws, only to the extent that they result from the generalization of individual impulses. General norms always presuppose concrete facts from which they can be derived. But facts are first created by human action. When we seek for laws or concepts in the actions of individuals, peoples, and eras, we discover an ethics that is not a science of ethical norms, but a natural history of morality. Only the laws obtained in this way relate to human conduct as natural laws relate to a particular phenomenon. But they are by no means identical with the impulses on which we base our actions. If we want to understand how a human action springs from ethical willing, we must look first to the relationship of that willing to the action in question. First, we must focus on actions for which this relationship is decisive. If I or another later reflect upon such an action, let me read that again, if I or another later reflect upon such an action, then we can discover which ethical principles are relevant. While I am acting, An ethical principle moves me to the extent that it can live within me intuitively. It is united with love for the goal that I wish to realize through my action. I do not consult any person or code with the question, should I perform this action? I perform the action as soon as I have grasped the idea. Only in this way is it my action. The actions of those who act only because they recognize particular ethical norms result from the principles present in their moral code. Let me read that again. The actions of those who act only because they recognize particular ethical norms result from the principles present in their moral code. They are mere executors. Excuse me. They are mere executors, a higher form of robot. Toss an opportunity to act into their awareness, and right away the clockwork of their moral principles sets itself in motion and runs its course in a lawful fashion to produce a Christian, humane, or apparently selfless action, or one for the sake of the progress of civilization. Only when I follow my love for an object is it I myself who act. At this level of morality, I do not act because I acknowledge a Lord over me, or an external authority, or a so-called inner voice. I acknowledge no outer principle for my action, because I have found within myself the basis of my acting, love for the action. I do not check rationally whether the action is good or evil. I do not because I love it. My action becomes good in my intuition, steeped in love. My action becomes, quote-unquote, good if my intuition, steeped in love, stands in the right way in the intuitively experienceable world continuum. It becomes bad if that is not the case. I do not ask myself, how would another person act in my situation? Rather, I act as I, this particular individuality, want or will. What directs me is not common usage, not general custom, not a universal human principle, and not an ethical norm, but my love for the deed. I feel no compulsion, neither the compulsion of nature which guides me in my drives, nor the compulsion of ethical commandments. I simply want to carry out what lies within me. Defenders of universal ethical norms might object to these arguments as follows. If all people strive merely to express themselves and to do as they please, then there is no difference between a good action and a crime. Every bit of knavery within me has equal claim to expression with the intention to serve the universal good. As an ethical human being, what should be decisive for me is not the mere fact that I have focused on the idea of an action, but rather my determination of whether the action is good or evil. Only if I have determined that it is good should I carry it out. My response to this objection, which seems plausible, but arises only from a misunderstanding of what is meant here, is this. Anyone who wants to know the essence of human willing must distinguish between the path that brings willing up to a certain stage of development and the special form that it assumes when it nears its goal. On the path to this goal, norms play their justifiable role. The goal consists in the realization of ethical aims that are grasped purely intuitively. Humans achieve such aims to the degree that they possess any capacity to lift themselves to the intuitive conceptual content of the world. In any individual act of willing, other things are generally mixed in with such aims as motive or motive power. But intuition can still determine or co-determine human willing. What we should do, we do. We offer the stage upon which should becomes do. An action is our own if we allow it to emerge as such from within ourselves. Here, the impulse can only be completely individual. In truth, only an act of will emerging from intuition can be individual. Only if blind drives are reckoned to belong to the human individuality can we see a criminal deed or evil as an expression of individuality equivalent to the incarnation of pure intuition. But the blind drive that drives someone to commit a crime does not come from intuition. It does not belong to what is individual within a person. It belongs to what is commonest, to what is equally present in all individuals, and out of which we must work our way with our individuality. What is individual in me is not my organism with its drives and feelings, but my own world of ideas that lights up within this organism. My drives, instincts, and passions establish no more in me that I belong to the general species human being. The fact that something conceptual expresses itself in a special way in those drives, passions, and feelings establishes my individuality. Through my instincts, my drives, I am the kind of person of whom there are 12 to the dozen. I am an individual by means of the particular form of the idea by which, within the dozen, I designate myself as I. Only a being other than myself could distinguish me from others by differences in my animal nature. I distinguish myself from others by my thinking, that is, by actively grasping what expresses itself in my organism as conceptuality. Thus we cannot say that the action of a criminal proceeds from an idea. In fact, what is characteristic of criminal acts is precisely that they derive from non-conceptual elements within a human being. Insofar as an action proceeds from the conceptual part of my individual being, it is felt to be free. Every other portion of an action, whether it is performed under the compulsion of nature or according to the requirement of an ethical norm, is felt to be unfree. Humans are free to the extent that they are able to obey themselves at each instant of their lives. An ethical deed is only my deed if it can be called a free deed in this sense. We have examined under which conditions a willed act is felt to be free. What follows will show how this purely ethically understood idea of freedom realizes itself in human nature. To act out of freedom does not exclude moral laws, but rather includes them. Still, it stands on a higher level than action dictated by moral laws alone. Why should my action serve the welfare of the whole any less if I have acted out of love than if I acted only because I feel a duty to serve the welfare of the whole? The simple concept of duty excludes freedom, because duty does not recognize individuality, but demands instead subjection of individuality to a general norm. Freedom of action is thinkable only from the standpoint of ethical individualism. But how is it possible for humans to live together socially if everyone is striving merely to express his or her own individuality? This objection is characteristic of misguided moralism, which imagines that a society of human beings is only possible if they are all united by a commonly determined ethical order. Such moralism fails to understand the unity of the world of ideas. It cannot conceive that the world of ideas that is active in me is none other than the one that is at work in my neighbor. To be sure, this unity is merely a result of experience in the world, but it must be so. For if it were to be recognized in any way other than observation, then general laws, rather than individual experience, would give the stamp of validity in that realm. Individuality is possible only if each individual being knows another being by individual observation alone. The difference between me and my neighbor consists not in our living in two completely distinct spiritual worlds, but in my neighbor's receiving intuitions other than my own out of the world of ideas common to us both. My neighbors want to live out their intuitions, I mine. If we all really draw from the idea and follow no external, physical or spiritual impulses, then we cannot but meet in the same striving, the same intentions. An ethical misunderstanding, a clash, is impossible among ethically free human beings. Only someone who is ethically unfree, who obeys natural drives or the conventional demands of duty, will thrust aside someone else who does not follow the same instincts and the same demands.